again, at the time, I had a very restricted medical and didn't really know what I could do in flying. But I guess because I had a third class, I was able to instruct. So that kind of sounded like as good a plan as any. And I just fell in love with the seaplane flying from day one.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 31 of On the Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. On the Step is all about float planes and flying boats. I love them, and why wouldn't you? Do you love them just as much or even more than me? Well, if that's the case, tell a friend about this show, share it on your social media platforms, and write a review on Apple Podcasts. And as usual, to get in contact with me, my email is thatmallardguy@hotmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram and send me a message at thatmallardguy. If you are a regular listener to this show, you would have noticed by now that nearly everyone in America gets their seaplane endorsement through Jack Brown's in Winter Haven, Florida. I mean, even the guys who run the Catalina in the UK send their new business partners to Brown's before getting the cat wet. Well, finally the wait is over, because on today's episode I've got for you the president of the Jack Brown's seaplane base, Mr. Ben Shipps. Ben has risen to this position through an absolute passion for flying, and in particular seaplane instructing. What makes his story even more incredible is the fact that Ben was born with what doctors called an anomaly, where his arms didn't fully develop, leaving him with a short left arm with one finger and a fused right arm with just three fingers. What an inspiration to all of us to follow your dreams and never let anything set you back, no matter what. For now, folks, let's head into the classroom. With Ben controlling the PowerPoint, we'll take notes as he talks through the fundamentals of seaplane flying. Once we're done, we'll head to the docks to daily our bright yellow cub, getting her ready to get going on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Alrighty, welcome on the line, Ben Shipps. All the way from Florida in the United States, we've got the president of the Brown's Seaplane Base. Ben, welcome to On the Step, mate.
Thank you, Dan. Pleasure to be on here with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been hounding a lot of people in Florida to talk all things seaplanes, and everyone mentions Brown's Seaplane Base, mate. I even had a fella who... helps run a Catalina in the UK, and they say they get their pilots trained at Brown Seaplane Base. What is in the water over there, mate, and why is everyone talking about getting their float plane endorsement at Brown Seaplane Base?
I tell you, it's been a legendary place, and that's why I gave my rating here about 10, 11 years ago, and I totally got bit by that bug as well. It's a place that has a laid-back, friendly atmosphere. It feels more like a fishing camp out here on our dock, our back porch, but it's got some of the highest standards in the training industry as well.
Yeah, that's incredible, mate. We're going to really dive into all about Brown Seaplane Base very shortly, but what I want to do, mate, is jump back a little bit and start off and talk a little bit about yourself and how you got into flying, and was it all about flying seaplanes when you got into it?
No, it wasn't always about seaplanes. For me, growing up, I had several pilots in my own family, including my grandfather. He was actually started a sporting goods store in Michigan and used to do fly out hunting and fishing trips through customers through his store. And that was in a single engine CB in Michigan. And kind of grew up hearing these stories, but honestly, seaplanes is kind of a small niche. And you kind of think of the seaplane flying as days gone by. But you look out in different areas of the world, it's actually a necessary means of transportation. For me, when I got into flying myself, I got into land airplane flying at the local airport. And really, I was 4 years into flying before I actually had my first taste of seaplane flying myself.
You're right. So you grew up around that area as well, did you?
It was about 2 hours from where I am now in Winter Haven. I grew up an hour south of Tampa, a little town of Venice, right on the Gulf Coast. And we have a small uncontrolled airport there, and that's where I ended up doing my private pilot training. And it was a nice airport to learn to fly at. It was hard to get lost. You just fly up and down the coast until you found the rock jetty sticking out in the Gulf there. You knew you were home.
And so, mate, what were you kind of doing before you jumped into the flights there? Were you working as a commercial pilot?
No, sir. Actually, I was a student. I was going to school at a Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, and I was actually studying business management. And I ended up, he's now my best friend, but a fellow that I met through school had spent a summer in Alaska, and that just kind of piqued my interest. And I said, how did you get plugged in with that? And he just said he emailed about 30, 40 different outfits, and somebody said, hey, if you get your ticket up here, you can kind of work as a hangar boy. So I said, that sounded pretty cool and interesting. And at the time, I had a very restricted medical and a private pilot certificate. So it wasn't really, I didn't have a good plan to build hours, things like that. So I actually was looking at seaplane bases around my hometown, and I've learned of Jack Brown's here just, again, less than 2 hours from where I grew up. So when I was home on a summer break for a couple weeks, came up here and did the 2 day course, and just got totally addicted to it.
Yeah, that's incredible, mate. So how was Alaska, and how was that as a young fella getting over there? And what kind of aviation were you exposed to in Alaska?
Sure. So actually, when I when my friend told me about his Alaska experience, that led me to getting my seaplane rating. And I did that in hopes just to go work as a line guy, fueling and loading and unloading airplanes. But I ended up not going up there for another 2 years because I ended up, after I graduated from school, I moved down here and I became a flight instructor. And the only reason I became a commercial pilot and CFI was to teach down here in Florida at Jack Brown's. That really inspired me to get some more ratings and certifications. So 2 years after kind of starting that process, I actually got a job flying for a 135 outfit in Juneau, and it was kind of a dream come true.
Yeah, wow. And then what was the process there to jumping over to Brown's and becoming an instructor and working for them?
So it's a lot of autonomy. Basically, there's, it's our job to teach somebody up to the standard of the airman certification standards and get them ready to basically be a pilot in command of a seaplane. Oftentimes, it's just a day and a half or less after them first touching the controls of a seaplane. So it was really neat. You had a lot of leeway on kind of how you introduced the maneuvers, and you just kind of had to be just manage your own time wisely. Typically, it was 5 hours of dual instruction, but getting through the normal rough, glassy, confined area techniques. And it was, when I first started teaching at Brown's, one of the veteran instructors there said, this is the aviation job that, it's a lot of fun when you're doing it, but it's not until you leave it that you realize, kind of the gem of a job that you really had. And lucky for me, I've got to, I've stuck around for a while. And of course, I've worn several different hats over my short tenure so far.
Yeah, as president, that's a pretty big step up over those 10 years. So, mate, what about back at the start there when Jack Brown's or when you went there and started flying there? How did you find it being an instructor on the water? What was that like moving into an instructing role flying floats? I mean, I can only imagine there's not that many people flying seaplanes and instructing on them as well.
Well, I guess kind of rare from an instructor standpoint that while I have some other instructor ratings and certificates, very little of my instruction time is actually in land aircraft. So kind of my first dual given hour was on the water in a J3 Cub. And it's, the important place to start is thinking of the negative transfer items, just from starting up in a seaplane at a parking area. People are, one of the first things they look to do is to hold the brakes, before engine start. And so I think once you think of the differences, you get your curriculum going. You'll get your curriculum started as far as what are the things that I have to begin with. And I remember that was one of the toughest things that I struggled with as a new instructor was I have all these things I have to cover. Where do you even start? And I found the most effective way was just like I mentioned, if you cover those differences and think about what is that student going to be experiencing different from their land flying, and there's no brakes, and once you get going, everything's on the move, including the run-ups. So I just let people know it's like a choreographed dance. Once you hop in, you start up. You got to be thinking multiple steps ahead because you can't hold the brakes and hold short anywhere.
It's a pretty good dance partner, isn't it, as well, the J3 Cub. Mate, tell us a little bit about the aircraft that you operate there at Brown Seaplane Base.
So we've got several different types of single-engine seaplanes, but the workhorse, really, from day one that Jack Brown had here in 1963 was a Piper J3 Cub. Of course, back when he started, it was a 65-horse J3. We've actually got modified J3s now that they put out between 96 and 100 horsepower, either with the Continental C90 or a modified C85. But other than that, they're pretty much original. We have five J3s on straight floats, and they all range from years 1940 to 1946. And they're all yellow. They all have got little idiosyncrasies, but they actually surprise most people by their performance.
And do you have any other aircraft online as well?
We do. We also have a 1958 Piper Super Cub with the 0320, 150 horsepower. That's on straight floats. We have actually a recent addition, a Cessna, a 1964 Cessna 172. It's been upgraded with a 180 horsepower and a constant speed prop. And we also have a Mall M7 235, also on straight floats.
Okay, so there's a bit of variety there. When a student comes to Brown Seaplane Base to do some training there, do they choose what airplane they want to do the flying on, or is it straight to the Cub to start off with?
No, they can start out whatever aircraft they like. We do have weight limits, of course, with the J3 with limited useful load. So as long as they can fit in there and the weight and balance works, you know, the J3 is the most economical way to go, followed by the Super Cub, then the 172. But the Piper J3, in my opinion, is probably one of the best initial seaplane trainers out there, much in part to the lack of instrumentation. You really learn how to focus on the float and the hydrodynamics involved. You know, you get in a more complex seaplane and it's really all the same hydrodynamics, you know, getting the airplane on step and finding the sweet spot and dealing with the different water conditions. But the J3 is such a simple platform, systematically speaking. Really, it's a hard one to beat. You can really focus on the float and the water, exactly what you're doing and learning.
Yeah, and I can imagine as well that with those more powerful platforms that they kind of are a lot easier to fly on the water in a way. Whereas with the J3, maybe it's a bit more of a fight to get that thing on the step.
Well, sure, and that's the thing is I always let students know if they're working at all to get off the water, they're working too hard. You know, one of my favorite tools in teaching someone to fly is using reverse psychology. You know, I tell every instructor that ends up working here that you know they get hired as a psychologist that kind of knows how to fly, but. You know, I always let people know your job is not to take off in a seaplane, it's to set the airplane up for success. You know, if that airplane gets on step and you're patient, you got enough water in front of you, you know, it'll come off that water.
Yeah, wow. So, mate, talk to us a little bit about what, when a student comes to Brown's there, what's the process for them? Like, how long does the endorsement go for and what's the whole layout of the course?
People contact us, phone or email, and we're actually booking out close to 2 months right now.
Wow.
And when somebody gets on our schedule, we get their contact information. We send them our course guide, about a 30-page document, which just kind of goes hand in hand with the ACS, whether it be private or commercial, whatever add-on rating they're doing. So they get some study material, typically a month or two in advance of arriving here. let's say they start on a Monday morning. They check in 7:30 in the morning, get a little tour of the base, do some paperwork. 8 o'clock, ground school starts. And you know, our instructors, they kind of cycle through who's teaching ground. But typically, we're going to start one or two people each day, Monday through Friday, for the rating. They get out of ground school around 10 a.m. or 9:30. They do a walk around the aircraft, and they go fly. They typically get about 3.5 hours total flight time the first day, with about an hour's lunch break in between. And most people compare that first day as drinking from a fire hydrant. It is a lot of information. And there tends to be a bit of a bell curve in the learning process through there. Normally, they start out kind of regurgitating and monkey see, monkey do on the first flight. A lot of instructor input. Usually, the second flight in the afternoon, you kind of have that after-lunch lull. And, of course, the instructor's backing off a little bit, doing some review. And, of course, a little bit more tired. It all tends to come together nicely the second morning, though. Usually meet at 7:30. The student will do the walk around with the instructor looking over their shoulder. And they'll go flying. Typically, if everything is on track, they'll have about an hour to an hour and a half review session the second morning. Before they come back and they do the IACRA paperwork and the logbook sign off, and they take a check ride.
Well, it's a pretty quick process, hey? Only a day and a half or 2 days, really.
Sure. And of course, nothing's cookie cutter. You know, it's somebody coming in here that's not current or proficient, hasn't flown in years. We try our best to let them know early on that if you are not current or proficient, it may take longer. You know, we've had plenty of students that, they might stick around for several days getting it done. And I've seen double, triple the, minimum 5 hours, to get them check ride ready, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, not everyone is the same. And,
exactly.
It obviously depends on how much flying they've been doing, in those last kind of few months, I guess.
Sure. And we noticed the type of flying that they do makes a huge difference as well. You know, if it's mostly cross country or autopilot flying that they're doing, that won't really help them out in the pattern too much. So we always recommend, hey, if you're current proficient in a light airplane, especially in the pattern, doing your takeoffs and landings, most people have no problem at all doing the 2 day.
Have you noticed a big difference? I've actually spoken about this a lot with a few past guests. With the guys who have done a lot of tailwheel flying and when they jump over onto a float plane?
Absolutely. Yes, there are a lot of similarities. And actually, some of the little land instruction that I've done has mostly been with seaplane pilots, just for my group there. And they both help each other out. You know, the seaplane flying, it really wakes up your feet, wakes up your rudders, but not to the degree that a tail dragger does. So if somebody comes in and they're used to doing 3-point landings in a land airplane, we'll just tell them for a normal landing or rough water, hey, just come down, just give me a 3-pointer. And oftentimes we won't have to say anything else. They can land a plane just fine on the water. And when we get into glassy water landings, we'll say, hey, just give me a wheel landing. Just don't tack it on. Don't give me any forward once we touch. But there is a lot of positive transfer, yes, from tail draggers.
What are the things that you see in guests that it take a long time to learn? Like, what are the things that people really struggle with when they go over there and do their float plane endorsement?
So I'd say the most notorious one is glassy water operations, particularly the glassy water landing. You know, there's not too many times where you're in a land airplane and that, you know, as you pass over the threshold, the runway disappears. But that's exactly what happens on glassy water. And especially if we are only simulating, if we don't actually have glassy water, you know, an instructor is going to talk till they're blue in the face. But the student, they really, until they experience it, they really can't grasp the whole concept or why they're doing what they're doing. So, you know, most people before they come, they've watched videos and kind of see it. But again, until you've experienced it firsthand, that's when it makes a true believer out of you. But I would say that's notoriously the item that takes people the longest to really get down to a proficient level.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've looked at the map very often when I talk to people from your area there, and it's just incredible the amount of lakes that are around that Winter Haven, you know, Tampa Bay area. So you must see some really glassy conditions on some of those lakes, hey?
Yes. Yeah, this time of year, especially summertime, we're far enough inland, we don't really get any sea breeze at all. We're about as far away from the beach as you can get in Florida. So yeah, most afternoon, you know, it's hot, humid, and it's glassy water. So definitely being patient on that step. And on the landings, you know, we put out some pretty good products as far as students that know what they're doing on glassy water if they train this time of year.
And what about the flight training that you do? Speaking about those lakes, like, do you just go around hopping over different lakes? Do you have a set amount of lakes that you can operate in? How's that all work?
So our typical training radius from the base here is about 6 to 10 miles, and there's over 100 different lakes that we can hit in that radius, which is makes it pretty unique around here. In a J3, you're not going to get anywhere quick, so it makes it nice that we don't have to travel far to get to our training bodies of water. Now, of course, a lot of those lakes, there may be a lot of built up or houses, you know, downtown Winter Haven. So a lot of those lakes, I'd say close to 40 or 50 of them, are more surrounded by residential areas. So if we go there at all, it may be just for one or two landings tops. So we typically try to be sensitive to the neighbors. We try not to wear out our welcome. And a huge thing that we push is when somebody gets their seaplane rating, they're now representing all of us. And it's a privilege to operate on the water. And we try to do our best and play our part to keep these waterways open for future generations.
Yeah, it must be tough, you know, like, as you mentioned, a lot of those beautiful lakes are surrounded by, you know, houses with people who want to have this beautiful home on the water. And then I could only imagine the noise complaint issues you might have when all these little seaplanes are flying around day in, day out, you know, on the water there. We have a lot of issues with noise complaints in Australia here. So how do you manage that?
Sure. Yeah. So it's it can be a bit seasonal. We have, you know, typically in the fall when we get people coming down from up north, we affectionately will refer to somebody migrating down yearly as snowbirds, you know, getting out of the cold winter weather. If they've never been to the area and they're not used to seeing seaplanes, we often, you know, usually every fall, get at least two or three phone calls from law enforcement or Winter Haven Fire Department just saying, hey, you know, somebody saw an airplane, you know, doing a crash landing on a lake in the area. And of course, yeah, your heart races for a few moments, but you know, it's usually just somebody new to witnessing a seaplane operation. So we kind of take that as a grain of salt. But also, you know, our instructors are very good about spreading out. Again, we got five almost identical J3s, so the community may see and just think that it's one really busy float plane. So if somebody's been on one lake for two or three landings and then they see them leave, we, you know, make sure that instructor doesn't jump in right behind them, because to the person living on that lake, you know, they just seen that one yellow cub operating on that lake for an hour, even though it might have been three different people training. So we really try to spread the noise out, and we don't really have the structure of, you know, left-hand traffic or right-hand traffic. So, again, there's a lot of autonomy. It's a different level of freedom, this seaplane flying. And we really, I think we have a huge responsibility. And when we're doing this initial seaplane training, to instill that in the students, that this is a different level of freedom, but none one that you don't want to be abusing. I usually give students the talking to that, when they become a seaplane pilot, it's as if they just turned 16 and got the keys to the family car. You get a lot of freedom, but you also have a lot more responsibility and chances to abuse that responsibility too.
Yeah, that's a fair shout, mate. And like you said, you're representing the rest of the community. We don't want to have people who go out there and really annoy people and give seaplane pilots a bad name, because that affects the whole industry as a whole. So You reminded me of a story actually in the Mallard with the whole getting a phone call about the plane crash. We had a flight. We were doing some flying in the Mallard down and landing just off the Darwin City in the harbour where we live here. And, you know, talk about one thing with a cub, for example, landing on the water and someone thinking it's a plane crash. Well, that thing's got two big pontoons that actually look like it should be on the water. When you talk about a Mallard, it just looks like a normal aeroplane to most people. That's because they can't really tell that the aeroplane's supposed to land on the water. So we landed on the harbour there, and there was a few phone calls to the police going that there's a plane that's just crashed in the harbour there. And I don't know what happened when they saw us go and drop an anchor and pop out the front there. And we were sitting there floating for a long time, and a boat came and picked us all up and everything. But we actually eventually got the water police to come over, and they had a bit of an inspection and figured out that I think the plane was actually meant to be there rather than not. So, yeah, it's a common one, isn't it, to see an aeroplane come down and touch down. But, yeah, with the hull, it's completely – it looks like it's not supposed to be there for sure.
Like another land plane.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Mate, you mentioned there that you're doing so many you know, float plane endorsements, 2 months booked out in advance. That's pretty incredible. I can't imagine, especially this time of the year as well, that there is a lot of float jobs going around. So what's the kind of ratio between, you know, guys who are commercial pilots versus private pilots getting their float plane endorsement?
So it's right now we're seeing a lot of commercial pilots. And I'd say typically it might be 50-50, you know, private, commercial. But right now it's overwhelmingly leaning towards commercial, but much in part to COVID and a lot of these commercial jobs kind of slowing down, and a lot of folks are still getting paid, thank goodness, during this time. So people are kind of looking for things to do in this slower time. So we've had a lot of an increased number of airline pilots. But yeah, most of it's been commercial. Again, we might get 3 to 5 private pilots a week as well. But most of them are doing it as a bucket list item. They've been wanting to do it for a long time, just putting it off. And I'd say once or twice a month, you might get somebody in that's looking to actually in search of a job on floats or even looking to get a seaplane of their own someday.
Yeah, I was going to say, I imagine that the bucket list item was a big one for a lot of people that just want to go down there and tick it off and have a go at it. Sure. Do you also offer any kind of hire of seaplanes for those who may have ticked the bucket list but then have their float plane endorsement but don't have any access to a float plane?
Right now, we do not offer any solo rentals of our aircraft. It's just dual only. Typically, we actually fly with almost just as many people as we certify every year. Almost that same number come back in and every year and just do recurrent training. You know, might take an instructor with them and just go out and maybe even take an airplane to lunch on some waterfront restaurant. But you know, we actually had three folks today. One did an intro flight, another was a returning customer. They come out, you know, fly anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours just to go knock some rust off.
Yeah, that must be pretty handy to get back into it. And as you mentioned, this time of the with everything going on with COVID, I imagine a lot of people just want to get out and get flying. So if they've already ticked that off, they probably just want to get out and get up in the air and have a bit of fun on the water for sure.
Yes. Yeah, it's a tough seaplanes are very tough to find for solo rentals. You know, there are some schools around that offer that, but typically it's set up in the form of like a flying club where there's a yearly membership and then a hourly as well, and usually an extensive checkout process. It kind of gets you on the insurance, basically.
Mate, also, I wanted to speak a little bit about, you know, landing gear issues. Obviously, you've got straight float seaplanes there, but what kind of things do you offer to your students, mainly in advice, I guess, about operating an amphibian seaplane?
Yeah, so the some of the biggest advice just comes up in what is your seaplane rating good for? What can you, what does this mean as far as what can you apply it to in other seaplanes? And most people are shocked to find out that when they get their rating in a J3, you know, if they have a high performance and complex endorsement, they can essentially go hop in a Cessna 185 or 206 on amphibious floats and be completely legal. So we of course, most people, if they've got some common sense, they're going to know, well, that's, even though I'm legal, I'm not going to go abuse that freedom. And the strange thing enough, too, we'll get people that come train our MAL or 172, and technically it's a complex airplane, even on straight floats. All it needs is a constant speed prop and flaps. So we've had plenty of people that came in as, let's say, just a private pilot, never had their complex endorsement, and they had to receive one of those to act as PIC on the check ride. And we really have to give them a very thorough briefing on, hey, you're getting this complex endorsement, but technically they haven't operated the gear. So, of course, a lot of that boils down to pilot discretion and common sense. But, of course, insurance companies tend to fill in the gaps these days anyway.
So with that whole complex endorsement, I don't know how you guys work over there, but would that student be able to go and fly a retractable undercarriage aircraft after that check flight, or is it the retractable still a separate endorsement for you?
So the complex for a land airplane, it requires three items, you know, constant speed prop, flaps, and a retractable landing gear. Whereas if it's a seaplane, to be complex, it only requires constant speed prop and flaps. So if somebody holds a complex endorsement, it just says for airplane. So technically any airplane that would be complex, they would be legal to operate as pilot in command.
Wow. So literally they could come and do a float plane endorsement with you and then go out and fly, like, say, I don't know, 210. And
exactly.
Wow. And how does that work for you with kind of liability, I guess, when you haven't done any training on gear, for example?
Sure. And that's where it really boils down to, of course, our instructors really stressing the point of the privileges that they do get with the rating. Our job is to really focus on the float, the seaplane side, and interacting with different types of water conditions, you know, parking scenarios. But really, it's a lot of common sense that has to be leaned upon there, and not to go out and abuse it. And gear down landing in the water, you know, let's say somebody came in and they never operated an amphibious aircraft, it's a totally different thought process. You know, if they're just used to flying a Bonanza or 210 retractable gear, and we let them know, hey, every time you've gone in for a landing, you're selecting the gear down and you're verifying that it's down. And that's exactly how gear down in the water landings will take place. Just kind of getting in a groove, even just pulling out a checklist and going line by line won't save you sometimes. So you have to be, I call it the Captain Obvious checklist, but you just got to be stating well before you get into the pattern, hey, what type of landing am I doing? Water landing gear up, land landing gear down.
Yeah, it's obviously a pretty hot topic at the moment. There's been a lot in the States in the last couple of months.
Sure.
Including, I know of two that happened on the same lake within 10 days, and both, you know, turbine-operated aircraft. So, you know, talk about complex. You know, that's a huge step up from just a single, you know, single engine piston with flaps. I'd call that a lot more complex. But it's a hot topic, and you know, I've done a podcast or an episode just previously about that topic in general. So hopefully, we can kind of keep talking about the issue to the industry and making sure that people have an extra think, like you said, do that Captain Obvious checklist and really have a think about what they're landing on, because it just keeps happening and we want to put a stop to it. So,
sure. And we will, if somebody comes in here, let's say they bought a new 206 and they got it on amphibious floats, oftentimes we'll train people in their own aircraft as well. And typically what I've seen when people are making mistakes and missing big items like that, it's typically from a lack of a good traffic pattern. You know, because again, you get this all this freedom. You don't necessarily have a structured pattern entry that you technically have to follow. Doesn't mean you should simply forego that traffic pattern, though. So it's more important when you get in the seaplane flying, if there's no structure created for you, such as a concrete runway to line up with, I always have said, it takes a very active imagination to be a very successful seaplane pilot. because in that absence of that structure, you've got to really create your own.
Yeah, exactly. And I can only imagine around that area, the Winter Haven area, that, you know, with so many little lakes, you could be airborne and just get to 200 feet and go and touch down on another lake. And it must be a hard kind of culture to create that routine because of the fact, you know, imagine just getting airborne and, you know, 20 seconds later you could touch down again. But to try and create a culture of getting up to maybe 500 feet and having doing a water inspection of that landing area and then going through that pattern and coming down and, you know,
sure.
I guess for some people without patience, you know, they could find that very frustrating when they're turning a 20-second sector into maybe a 2-minute sector, for example.
Absolutely, that is a daily battle for our instructors. Just getting people to slow down, and again, you don't technically have the structure that's saying, hey, you have to do this. And it may look, you know, you got a big lake and you're only taking up a little spot of it, but you know, you don't really know what you're landing on. So go check it out. You know, every water landing is an off airport landing.
Yeah, exactly. With us in the Mallard, you know, every flight, it's almost a bit like a carrier landing because, you know, you fly straight over the top of the carrier, which is your landing area, and then you join that kind of pattern area. And the idea of that not only is to make sure you run checks and whatnot, but it's to have a really good visual inspection of where you're landing. As you mentioned, every water landing is a different one. There could be floating debris. For us, we land, you know, at Pearl Farm, so it's always good to check, you know, where we are landing relative to all these lines in the water, which are obviously big obstacles. So, and checking wind and terrain and what your landing take off and areas are going to be like. So, yeah, it's one of those things with seaplanes, isn't it? That you've got to put up with. You know, it's not complete freedom, but it's one of the things that also makes float plane flying so much fun.
That's right. Get a few more variables.
Exactly, mate. Now you're the president of Brown Seaplane Base. Tell us a little bit about what that role entails.
Well, sure. So and I'm still wet behind the ears as that role. I'm a following it in the footsteps of my father-in-law, John Brown, and he has kind of paved the way, and he was president and examiner of the flight school here for 42 years. So every time I get out to the seaplane base, I feel like I'm stepping in a pair of shoes as long as our dock is. It's just trying to, I feel like the current caretaker, and I'm very thankful that my father-in-law, John Brown, is still out here, you know, most every day of the week still, and I'm able to kind of draw on his years of wisdom in doing it. And that, to me, he's just a, love him as a father-in-law, but, he's just an icon, a legendary guy of a gigantic size, for me in the seaplane flying as well. So, to me, he's just a tremendous resource on kind of been there, done that. So I feel very blessed to, not be walking into this roll blindly or into the dark or even making the same mistakes that have been done in the past. So, you know, one of the earliest things that John taught me was, you know, make sure I knew where all the cleaning supplies were for cleaning the bathrooms in the morning. So that's a good thing to keep your feet on the ground and keeps your head where it should be as far as prioritizing. You know, I think for me, a good leader leads by example. You know, it would be very easy. And I've had people that work for me say, hey, why don't you just have me clean those bathrooms? And it's just one of those things that, again, it's a lot easier to pull the rope than to push a rope. So doing the normal day-to-day stuff. But as far as checking out instructors and things like that, you know, I'm slowly delegating different things, such as checking out new instructors to delegating those things to more senior instructors that have been here for a couple of years. Just freeing my time up as well, because one thing that kind of went hand in hand with me taking over the business was me getting designated as a pilot examiner, and that kind of allowed my father-in-law to, you know, semi-retire at least. That way he's not out doing the daily grind of the check rides.
Yeah, it's an incredible history, mate. So as you mentioned, huge shoes, but you know, it's great that you still got those guys around to offer advice and, you know, to be there and talk about what's going on with the business and whatnot. So yeah, it must be great to have them around still. Can you tell us a little bit more about the history of Brown's?
So Jack Brown, actually from West Virginia, started flying seaplanes in 1938. He had a Ronca C-3 on floats and was flying off the Kanawha River up there before actually enlisting in the Navy. And when he went to the Pacific as a pilot, of course, at the time he was already a flight instructor and had many flight hours. So actually he was usually flying basically officers around in various aircraft, including the PBY, Catalina, Kingfisher, but was a naval aviator in the Pacific during World War II. When he came back to the States, he was a flight instructor in Bartow, which is was an Army air base that's just south of Winter Haven here. Yeah, we're just outside their airspace here. And in 1960, Jack Brown ended up buying the first FBO here at Winter Haven Airport. And 3 years later, ended up taking a J-3 on floats and on trade. I'm not sure what he traded, but I'm sure he got the better end of the deal with the J-3 on floats. Where the seaplane base is now, back in the early 60s, was just overgrown marshland. And they ended up just clearing away and just backed this J-3 on floats down through the grass and started doing some seaplane rides and some seaplane instruction, mostly for people that he knew, and ended up starting to construct the building that's still standing now. And much of it looks very much the same. We've tried to kind of keep that same vintage feel. I think that's what's neat. People come back 30, 40 years after being here initially, and they say, hey, you know what? I sat right there on the dock after I got my seaplane rating. So it's really neat seeing the history, and that it hasn't always been about, hey, what's latest and greatest. There's a lot of history here, and we really cling on to that. It's what has made the place what it is. But Jack ran this operation until 75, and he was actually killed he was ferrying a single-engine CB. And that's when my father-in-law, John, took over in 1975.
What relation were they?
So Jack was John's father.
Okay.
So Jack had two sons, two daughters, and the two boys were pilots. And John at the time was going to school in Tennessee and was kind of had his sights set on becoming an airline pilot. And Jack's youngest son, Chuck, who is ironically also a DPE and has been for many years now as well, was instructing here at the seaplane base.
Yeah, well, it's a real family affair, isn't it?
It really is, yes, sir.
And I'm guessing father-in-law, does that mean that you've married one of John's daughters?
That's correct. So when I did my rating here, I guess that was in 2010, John, my now father-in-law, said if I got my commercial and my CFI, he'd love to have me down here instructing for him. And again, at the time, I had a very restricted medical and didn't really know what I could do in flying, but I guess because I had a third class, I was able to instruct. So that kind of sounded like as good a plan as any, and I just fell in love with the seaplane flying from day one. So I went back to school and changed my major from business management to commercial aviation. And over that following 11 months, I did my commercial certificate, my CFI, and started teaching down here at Brown's. It was actually my first day getting trained as an instructor here that I met my wife. She had just graduated from University of Florida, and she was in at the base filling out some teaching job applications. So we got to talking, and 3 weeks later, I was in the boss's office to ask him permission to date his daughter. So I don't know if I was brave or something else. So,
wow. That's not usually the third week question most pilots come to the boss with.
It was not. She is a real catch, and I married up, that's for sure.
Happy days. And you got a little family now as well, mate?
That's correct. So we've been married almost 7 years. We've got two kids. One'll be five, always 4.5, and then my daughter, she'll be 2 end of the month.
Wow, killing it, bro.
Sure.
Mate, you mentioned there a couple of times, and feel free not to discuss this topic if you don't want to, but the restricted medical part of that, what's going on behind the scenes there?
Sure. So, no, I'm very open about it. I was born, I guess, well, the doctors call it an anomaly, but I was born with my arms did not fully develop. So my left arm is short, and I've got just one finger on it, and my right arm is fused at the elbow, and there's only 3 fingers on that one. And when I first started flying in 2007, I had all of three hours under my belt, dual received, and the medical examiner walked in the door and said, "Hey, this isn't going to work out for you, buddy. Go pick up another hobby," and kind of went on to the next patient. But of course, 3 hours in, I was already hooked on flying. So I said, "Hey, do what you need to do," and pass it up the line. And that was in March of 07. It wasn't until December of 2007 that I actually was able to take a medical flight test with an inspector, and actually ended up taking my private pilot check ride that same day.
Well, that's incredible. It must have been really hard, I guess, because, aviation is such a medically restricted industry, isn't it? Like, what you can and cannot do is generally, related to your medical conditions or, having that class of medical. How was it at the start there to almost feel like you were told that you couldn't do what you were falling in love with because of a medical condition?
Yeah, so, I kind of, I viewed... and of course I was born that way, and it wasn't the first roadblock or hurdle that I'd come across. So I can say that all the telephone operators at the FAA medical branch, they knew me and my dad by our first name, and every other day when we called, they said, "Oh, you again." So squeaky wheel gets the grease kind of thing, just to kind of keep the paperwork moving along. But I knew what I could do. I knew what I was capable of. And just because something is difficult didn't mean it wasn't meant to be either. So, for me, I felt like the Lord put flying on my heart. And I'm a firm believer in Philippians 4:13 that I can do anything that through the Lord's strength. And God has really been faithful to me in taking down these hurdles.
Yeah, that's great, man. It's great to hear that you kind of kicking goals. I mean, president now of Jack Brown's. Have you told the guy who said you couldn't do it back then, like, this is where I am now?
If somebody had told me just, I've been flying now about 14 years, but even going back 8-9 years, if somebody said, "Hey, you'd be giving check rides to people now," that would be hard to believe. I feel immensely blessed to be where I am, do what I love to do. I always jokingly tell people, but I'm dead serious. It really does beats having a real job. The fact that I get to wake up every morning and go do something that I have a passion to do, and really the best part of aviation is sharing it with others. And I get to do that every day. And again, talking airplanes. When you ask me if I wanted to do this, nobody ever has to twist my arm to talk flying.
Exactly.
So this is great.
No, mate, congratulations, and it's great that you're living out your passion. Now, mate, we're getting to the end of the show here, and I want to finish the chat with my infamous splash and dash questionnaire, just like the land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash. We're just going to touch on a few seaplane-related questions. First of all, what is your favorite seaplane that you have flown?
Ooh, it'd probably have to be the DHC-2, the de Havilland Beaver on floats. That's probably my favorite one. I can't say it's the top performer, but it's, I think, just a plane on floats. It was just a proper marriage of machine that was built and designed for the water. Just the pickup truck that it is, and of course, that R985 is a tough sound to beat as well.
Pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It really is.
And mate, what about you? Have you got a dream seaplane that you'd love to fly?
That's a good question. I have seen pictures of a Supermarine Spitfire on floats, Now, I don't know about there's not a ton of them flying, let alone one on floats. But for me, I think my favorite fighter would be the Spitfire, and one on floats. That would just be a dream come true.
Now we're talking. That's one of the most unique answers I've had so far. I don't know if. Do you reckon it ruins it with floats? I mean, they're such a iconic aircraft, aren't they? Without the floats.
Yeah. Well, actually, they had one. I think they were called the. I don't know if they were called the Seafire, but there was. If you Google Spitfire on floats, you actually see some. They're pretty neat looking. So I don't know how widely they were used, but I don't know if they came out during or just after World War II.
Speaking of, I guess, good looking, what do you think is the best looking seaplane?
Well, I'm not just saying this because you're that Mallard guy, but I really do like the Grumman lineup, but particularly the Mallard. I've got about 20 minutes in at the controls of a turbine Mallard, and that was quite an airplane. I think they just have very romantic lines to them, and I wish there were a lot more of them still operated commercially.
Yeah, was that time down on the coast there at the old Chalks outfit?
No, this was actually right here out of Winter Haven, right by our seaplane base. A good friend and neighbor of mine was piloting one for an individual for for several months, and it was based for several weeks here at our facility, at least at the land airport. So got a little exposure there, and that was something else.
Did you get to put it in the water?
Yes. Yep. Happy able days. To. We took off from land and went out and hit some of the lakes around the area, and actually landed it back in our small lake here. We got about 3,600 foot pond here that our seaplane base is on, and put on there and taxied up and just nosed in at the beach.
Yeah, epic, bro. Mate, final question. What kind of advice would you have for those aspiring to get their seaplane rating or even become a commercial seaplane pilot? Obviously, you would see and speak with a lot of people in the industry. What do you kind of share with them?
So first thing I would say is one of the biggest turnoffs for people to not get their seaplane rating or do any seaplane training is because they're going to say, well, I'm never going to use it again. It wasn't until I did my seaplane training that you really discover all the positive transfers, all these new ways of reading the wind on the water. You know, that actually helps improve your land airplane flying, and especially the situational awareness. It's one of the most practical type of flying that you do out there. You know, even from not relying so much on an ATIS or AWAS that could be, you know, up to an hour out of date. You know, instead just looking at what you got around you and using the environment. And one of the biggest things that seaplane flying teaches you is, you know, we're usually flying at lower altitudes, and I always let people know that as you mature as a seaplane pilot, but any pilot for that matter, you've got to be thinking far enough ahead to leave yourself options, but especially in aircraft that typically don't have very good glide ratios with floats below them, and you're not very high to begin with. So definitely, you know, making your route of flight maybe on the downwind side of the lake. That way you're already on base, you know, if you have to put the airplane down in a forced landing situation. And if there's no water, hey, you got some open fields that you can put the airplane down. But it just makes you think about things differently, even if you never touch the controls of a seaplane again. It makes you that much more well-rounded and that much more just in tune with the environment around you.
Yeah, very good advice, mate. Well, Ben, it's been great having you on to talk all things float planes, especially at a company I've been hanging out to speak with someone from. So I'd like to thank Ben Shipps from Brown Seaplane Base for coming on the step, mate.
Well, Dan, thanks for having me. And if you're ever over here stateside, I'd love to take you up in a J3.
Don't worry, mate. I've got a huge, big bucket list now of all these places from people I've spoke to on this show.
And, I'm sure you do.
Florida keeps coming up, so I'm definitely going to have to get over there in the future.
Well, very good. Well, thanks again for having me.
No worries, mate. All the best.
Take care.
And that's the show for today, folks. What a legend Ben is, and I thank him, as I'm sure you all will too, on taking the time to share his incredible story and for being so open about personal stories as well. Make sure you check out Browns if you're in the market for some fun float flying or float training, and you can follow them on Instagram at Browns_seaplane. As usual, folks, now is the time to share this episode, tell a friend, and review with Apple Podcasts. I think when COVID is over, I might as well move to Florida, because I'm staying in the Sunshine State for next episode, talking to Joshua Maddox, who flies for Tropic Ocean Airways, and here is a little taste.
So that's a really challenging thing. Anytime we're doing any of this hurricane relief work or anything like that, you're going into not only an area that maybe we've never been before, but it's also an area that's just been absolutely decimated by, you know, a Category 5 hurricane. So the water's churned up. You're not going to be able to see anything. There could be debris floating right under the surface. The winds are still howling pretty good. You know, you're still, even after several days after a hurricane, you're still going to end up with, you know, 20, 25 knot winds out there.
But until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.